inviting diverse thought leaders to explore topics designed to spark our collective imagination. Welcome to AKQA Insight.
Today we welcome Dr. Adam Kucharski, who is an associate professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, where he develops mathematical approaches to understand how outbreaks spread and how we can control them. He is a TED Senior Fellow and author of the new book, Rules of Contagion, Why Things Spread and How They Stop. I'm your host, Sam Sterling, Managing Director of AKQA in Greater China in Japan, and I'm talking to Adam about the underlying principles of a virus and how we might apply those to businesses and brands.
So whether you're looking at content being shared online or whether you're looking at infections or violence, for each event we have, how many more events does that create?
One of the things that we obviously need to be very clear about is the message and being on point.
If the content you're promoting is encouraging critical thinking and is giving more facts, that will have an effect on susceptibility.
Adam, thank you so much for joining me today from London for AKQA Insight. I know how busy you are at the moment, so we really appreciate your time. Like you, we're not doctors or scientists, so today I'd love to talk to you about viruses in a pretty different way to some of the questions that you typically answer. Now, in your most recent book, The Rules of Contagion, you describe viruses on a structural level rather than a medical level. You say that viruses have three key elements: opportunity, the duration that someone is infectious, transmission probability, and susceptibility to infection. I'm wondering if you can start off by unpacking those a little bit more for us.
Sure. I think when we're looking at things that spread, whether it's a virus or a piece of content or something else, these three elements are really important. So first of all, opportunities. That's really, for the period that someone is capable of spreading infection, the number of interactions they have or the chances they encounter other people where there's a chance to spread that infection to someone else. But of course, it's not just about interactions. It's also about what happens during those interactions. And that's where we think of this concept of a transmission probability. For a biological virus, you might come into contact with somebody and then cough and then the virus gets across, or you might not and you don't have that transmission. So in that case, you have this probability. And then the final thing we need to consider, of course, is susceptibility. You might have an interaction, the transmission might get across, but if that other person isn't susceptible to infection, then you're not going to see transmission occur.
Okay, so in that case, what are the early signs of a virus? What are the indicators that something that we're dealing with is viral?
What we tend to look for in the early signs is something that is unusual in its transmission. So often we'll see a lot of things that act as what we call stuttering transmission. So they might spread to one or two people, but not really take hold in a population. So what we often look for is a signal that on average, each person is creating more infection than there was before. And that's usually a very good early indicator that you're going to get something that will grow over time rather than fade away.
So that's the notion of, I think in your book, you referred to it as an R value.
Exactly. So the R value measures how much additional transmission is created for each case. So whether you're looking at content being shared online or whether you're looking at infections or violence, for each event we have, how many more events does that create? And if that number is above one, if on average each infection is generating more than one additional infection, you're going to expect to see growth over time.
So given that, what does it mean for something to spread virally? You just spoke about violence, suggesting that things other than kind of medical factors can spread virally. And I'm just a little bit interested to know more about that.
Yes, I think there's a lot of behaviours and characteristics which we're now getting more evidence can spread, because of course there's many different explanations for why, for example, two people who are linked socially might share a particular characteristic, whether it's a behaviour or some feature. It might be that these characteristics are random and they've chosen to be friends because of it. So, for example, you might become friends with someone because you share a hobby or an interest or something like this. Or it might be because you have some contagion effect that actually one event is leading to another. And one quite clear signal we can look at, whether we're talking about something like violence or maybe something about characteristics, things like depression, is how these events occur over time. You know, so if you have a violent incident and then in the network of contacts that those people interact with, you have a subsequent incident and another one, that starts to give you that kind of pattern over time that gives an indication that contagion might be playing a role.
Oh, interesting. Now, normally we think of viruses being associated with something negative. Is it possible to have a good virus?
I think we can definitely have good things that can spread. I mean, I think particularly ideas and innovations and often messages that are important and positive to get out there. I think there's, as much as in my main line of work, there's the question of how do we stop harmful contagion from spreading. I think there are many people out there who have positive, useful messages that they want to spread and want to reach a wide audience. I think many of the ideas about what drives transmission can really be applied to both. You know, for trying to stop something, you're looking at the weak links that you can cut almost in the transmission chain, whereas if you're trying to get something to spread, you're looking for the important links that you can amplify.
Well, that's something that I was really interested to speak to you about. So could we apply the underlying concepts of virality to the notion of ideas in order to change cultures, disseminate information, start movements, that sort of thing?
I think we can. I think a lot of it helps by thinking about this stage of transmission I mentioned. So when we're trying to get something to spread, I think it's often quite tempting to focus on the content. I think people, particularly on online information, have this idea that you can craft the perfect tweet and it will go viral. But that's really focusing, what you're doing is you're focusing on the transmission probability there, because if you post something online, it will expose the people in your network to it, but then it's that transmission probability, that catchiness of it, that will influence whether it's shared. But I think we also need to focus a lot on the other aspects of transmission, for example, opportunities. A lot of studies of, for example, popular online content has found that it doesn't necessarily spread in the way we think it does. It doesn't spread as this clockwork, each person spreading it to two or three others, to two or three others over time. We do get rare examples like that, things like the Ice Bucket Challenge, where everyone nominated two others and they nominated people. But what typically happens with things that become incredibly popular online is that there's what we call a broadcast event at the center of it. So often you have one or two quite high profile people or outlets that will create this mass exposure event. And then you might have small stuttering bits of transmission that come off that. And a lot of the organizations actually and groups that have been very good at getting things to spread online have taken advantage of that characteristic. They're not trying to focus all their effort on the content. They're actually thinking about the structure of the network and what are the features of those opportunities that they can take advantage of to make sure, for example, something will spark. I mean, just to give a more topical example of that, we see it a lot in political coverage, that actually a lot of these more malicious groups who are trying to get messages out there will fire a lot more messages at high profile people in the network to create the illusion that a message has support. So we call it in online information, call it astroturfing, because it gives the illusion of grassroots support for a particular topic. And what that can do is eventually you get a politician or a journalist who has the impression that this is an important issue, and then they amplify it, and then you've got the message take off by itself.
So if we were to try and increase opportunity and transmission probability, it sounds like what I'm hearing is that we need to focus on creating some element of broadcast event. So giving it a really kind of high profile with the right people early on, who will then go about disseminating the information or the content or whatever it might be. Is that accurate?
I think broadly, that idea that you want to try and get these mass exposure events are true for a lot of content. But I think we also need to think a little bit about the social reinforcement side, there's some really nice work that's been done on what's known as complex contagion. So it's this idea that certain beliefs and messages need social reinforcement to take hold. A good example is when people change their Facebook profile picture to have the equal sign in support of marriage equality. And typically people would only adopt that once they'd seen quite a lot of their friends do it. So if you imagine if you're trying to get that message to spread, you might not read a single newspaper article and be convinced to do that, that you actually need some of that almost clustering in your friendship network so that people reinforce their own ideas. And there's quite a lot of evidence for these more complex messages. You need those broadcast events, but you also need those tight-knit groups of social reinforcement early on to build enough support for the idea to take off. I think also just in it is worth having that transmission probability in mind as well, because there is increasing evidence that certain forms of content are more transmissible. One classic example is things that stimulate a stronger emotional response. And I think there's good evolutionary reasons for that. The things that trigger those deep-rooted responses like fear and anger, really far back in our species history, we've got good reasons for taking that information seriously, because there's a kind of survival component to it. I think there's also evidence more recently looking at things like fake news that people really value novelty online. And that explains why a lot of fake content is popular, because if it's fake, by definition, it's newer than anything else you've seen. I think there's also a lot around, in terms of these experiments of what's transmissible, around things that relate to social content. So, for example, who are the good people, who are the bad people? These kind of stories typically spread more than other information might.
So novelty is a really interesting one, and I did want to speak to you about the idea of misinformation and fake news. If we're looking to change the culture of a company or to reposition a business or something like that, one of the things that we obviously need to be very clear about is the message and being on point. In your book, you talk about how vaccines work by reducing susceptibility. So if we're saying that an idea can be viral, is it possible to inoculate against misinformation in some way?
I think we can. I think we've seen a lot more focus on that appear in the last year or two. I mean, one of the advantages of reducing susceptibility is you don't have to worry so much about the other bits of the transmission process. If you have an outbreak, trying to track down everyone who's infectious and change interactions, much like we're seeing in the current environment, is really tough and intensive to do. So if you can just broadly reduce susceptibility, you don't have to worry so much about the outbreak dynamics, because you know that it won't spark in a population. I think for certainly a long time in online content, a lot of the discussion was around the messages themselves. I think there was this idea, certainly amongst a lot of commentators, that we could simply get rid of all bad information. And we saw a lot of platforms really struggling with that. And I think a good example was a couple of years ago where Pinterest actually came out and suggested that it was very difficult for them to reduce all of the harmful health information that was circulating online. So what they'd instead chosen to do was change how people were exposed to it. So the content was potentially still there. It was just much harder to be exposed. And I think what we're now seeing is a lot of platforms, certainly around coronavirus, I think that's been a real kind of trigger for them, is targeting susceptibility. So now if you search for information about the current outbreak online, you'll be prompted with more reliable information up front. So I think this really is an attempt to preemptively give people information that to some extent might inoculate them against things that they'll see subsequently.
Is that reducing susceptibility, or is that more about reducing the transmission probability if you're minimizing the availability of content that is inaccurate or information that's inaccurate, rather than, it sounds like, susceptibility in that case might be more about encouraging people to think more critically potentially?
It will be a combination of the two. I think what's one of the challenges with all these things is unpicking, and to some extent you probably don't just want to target one of these bits of transmission. So I think by putting other content more prominently, you're obviously downweighting misinformation, so you are making it harder to be exposed to and lowering that transmission. But equally, if the content you're promoting is encouraging critical thinking and is giving more facts, that will have an effect on susceptibility. So I think those really effective strategies, whether we're talking about disease outbreaks or information, will typically combine these different elements of transmission and try and reduce all of them as much as they can.
Something else that you spoke about in your book, and I've heard you speak about in some of the articles that you've written, is around the idea of mutation. Can you tell us a little bit more about how mutation works and if viruses always mutate?
So broadly, for biological viruses, mutation is just a change that happens in the virus's genetic sequences. So all viruses mutate. We see these errors occur in its genetic sequence over time. And for outbreaks, that can be very useful because it can help us track how things will spread, because depending on how similar viruses are, it gives us a clue about whether those outbreaks are linked. I think we see the same in terms of online information, for example. You will see just changes and tweaks and edits to content over time. But the real question is, do those mutations affect transmission? I mean, that's the concern we have with viruses, that we're not worried about generic mutations in a virus that are just errors in its genetic code. What we're potentially worried about is, are those changes going to increase its transmission? And generally, the answer is no. But we do see some examples, for instance, with things like bird flu. There is some evidence that there are mutations that can make it more transmissible. And similarly, with misinformation or online content, there are examples of edits to wording or framing of content that's made it more transmissible, and as it's mutated, it's improved its ability to spread.
So something that I'm personally quite interested in, and it's definitely something that we speak to our clients about at AKQA, is the idea of longevity of businesses and brands. So the ability to be able to pivot to stay relevant in the marketplace. I'm interested to know if you think that we could apply the concepts around mutation to a business or brand in order to keep it relevant and keep it alive.
I think there are a lot of examples of mutation, certainly at the information level, improving transmission, but you could obviously broaden those out to brands or larger scale organizations. And I think one of the things that needs to be considered is the timescales involved. But obviously, biological evolution has these huge long timescales to take advantage of. And that's much harder in a short period of time to do, whether you're talking about an idea or something like a brand. But there are examples of people doing it quite well. I mean, in terms of online sharing, we now have essentially large-scale experiments that often when something is launched, you'll see many different variants of it. And that allows a comparison of what is making something more transmissible and less transmissible. I think also what we're seeing in terms of certainly online sharing is a really intense competition for attention. And that has a direct analogy with infectious disease outbreaks, because for disease like flu, for example, there's lots of different strains and they're all competing for susceptible humans, basically. And that means that a strain that's slightly more transmissible, or a strain that's mutated in a way that gives it an advantage, can very quickly outcompete the other strains for the susceptible people, or in the case of information, people's attention. So I think it is those trade-off of those two factors. So one is ensuring that you can have the ability to test different variants and work out if they're more successful enough. But also it depends very much on the dynamics of what others are doing and that competition for attention.
That's fascinating. So you're saying that viruses effectively are competing against each other for a marketplace of humans, if we're talking about a medical virus. And the way they determine the most transmissible version of themselves is through experimentation of some kind?
Essentially, it's natural selection. So it's kind of it's this natural evolutionary process. But broadly, it is what we would do in terms of business or information, we would artificially create that process by creating variants and seeing what can spread. And we see that happening naturally. I mean, one example is things like online forums, where you often see huge variants of memes circulating. And then obviously the better, more popular memes get upvoted, and then those ones go on to create new memes. And what you end up with at the end is the most transmissible versions of all of those different types of edits that occurred previously.
Yeah, okay. I think it's quite interesting to think about some of the work that we do, like A-B testing or experimentation, as exploring the transmission probability or looking to increase the transmission probability of one of our products or whatever it might be. So something that we are seeing the world over at the moment is that populations aren't particularly good at following the guidelines that are given by their governments. I've heard various reasons that this might be because there's a lack of certainty or other variables. I'm just wondering if you have thoughts as to how we can get people to follow the guidelines that are provided by governments.
I think that's a really good question. It's also a really tough one, particularly I think in terms of our understanding of how to change behaviour. There's a huge amount of research that's particularly been done on online behavior or kind of large scale behavior, but those measures typically are quite easy to change. If you want someone to click on a link or share something, that's very different to getting someone to fundamentally change their daily routine. So I think there have been some challenges there, particularly just because we're in an unprecedented situation, understanding exactly the best way to do this. I think we've also seen just a lot of differences between cultures in terms of things being imposed versus trying to encourage more of this voluntary approach. I think also just in the messaging, for example, in the UK and I know a number of other countries, a lot of the messaging hasn't so much been about sort of telling people for their own individual good. It's more been focused on that community and this idea that what you're doing is reducing transmission and it's reducing the impact on others. And so I think there's evidence in certain places that can resonate quite effectively is actually making it that altruistic, more community-minded approach to what you're doing rather than just focusing on individual risk, which some people might perceive to be quite low.
That's a really interesting point. So forgive me if this gets a little outside your typical scope, but something that we've been discussing amongst ourselves in our studio in China is the difference between individualist and collectivist cultures. You mentioned cultures for a moment then. I'm just interested if you think that this is actually a version of collectivist versus individualist communities and cultures actually playing out in a way that we haven't really seen before.
I think there is an element to that. I think there's probably a number of dimensions to what's driving this. We also see factors probably influencing things like trust in government. And so I think some of these measures that are being proposed, I think, will be very influenced by whether people are taking that individual action versus communal one. I mean, we're seeing to some extent with the measures where there's more moderate control in place. For example, people are still allowed to go to parks or go outside and this sort of thing. If everyone is sensible, then obviously that can be maintained. But there's a bit of that. If individuals choose to benefit themselves over everyone else, you can end up with a more severe measure. So it's almost this prisoner dilemma type economic problem of do you act for yourself or do you cooperate with others going on. So I think there is probably going to be a cultural element to that. I think there will also be something just around the messaging that, you know, in some cases, governments haven't perhaps been as clear as they could be about actually what's being expected. But I think then there'll also just be part of that just underlying trust in the health system and particularly countries that have had perhaps recent experience of things like SARS might be far quicker to act on these. Because that's also the key thing, that it's not just people's underlying happiness to go along with things, it's also the speed with which they're happy to make those quite dramatic changes to their behaviour.
So your book is called Rules of Contagion, Why Things Spread and How They Stop. So given that, I'm really interested to know if you've learned anything new from the COVID-19 current kind of pandemic and outbreak.
I think there's a couple of things about this that on the spectrum of outbreaks we were potentially foreseeing as the next pandemic have been a bit more unusual. I mean, I think one is that if you had something like flu, because it's quicker in terms of the cycle of transmission from one person to the next, because a lot more people are asymptomatic, then a lot of these early attempts to isolate people and trace contacts really wouldn't have been very effective at all. So I think that the fact that the coronavirus almost sits a bit more at this boundary of it's almost containable with some of these early measures. And we've seen some countries, for example, like Singapore, manage for a very long period to keep this level of infection low and are now having to ramp up these lockdown type measures. I think that's been perhaps slightly less expected, that it wasn't something that just clearly spread uncontrolled straight away in every country, that there was this period that countries have had where it has been a bit more possible to maintain it. And I think there's also that's played out a bit in terms of the measures we've seen, because we have seen these more extensive lockdown measures. And I think that's, as a result, put a lot of countries in a very difficult position, that because there are these options, which are, we know, incredibly high burden on populations but can slow transmission, it now means that a lot of countries have got to a point where it's quite difficult to plan out what's happened next. We saw a lot of places, for example, have 2-week lockdowns, which have now been extended into 4 weeks and then maybe 6 weeks. And so I think we are really in unknown territory in terms of what populations can do. And obviously my work focuses on what outbreaks do and what the disease does. But of course, there's a number of really important other considerations around the social effects, the psychological effects, the impact on sort of household finances as well.
You've mentioned the factor of time a few times in our conversation. And so I'm just a little interested to hear more about that. You said that the coronavirus sits on the fringe of something that could be containable, largely owing, it sounds, to the notion of time. What kind of role does time play in how things spread?
It plays an enormously important role. And so if we think of just trying to contain that very early stage of an outbreak, a couple of things that will influence that is, one is how clear is it who's infected and who's not. For example, if you have an infection like, say, Ebola, a lot of people who are most infectious will have very clear symptoms and be very ill. And there's also, for something like Ebola, there's about a 2-week gap between someone becoming ill with very early symptoms, infecting someone, and then the person they infect will become ill about 2 weeks later. So if you imagine a case shows up, you have, first of all, you know who they are, or you've got a clear idea of who they are, and you've got a couple of weeks to identify who they might have had contact with and who might be at risk. For flu, a lot of that transmission happens when people don't have any symptoms or have almost no symptoms. And that turnover period is really maybe 2-3 days. So it's not only is it really difficult to spot people, by the time you have spotted them, you've probably got a couple of more cycles of transmission. So coronavirus kind of sits in between those two things. But timescale is also really relevant for a number of other infections. If you look at just at the individual level, on average, how much transmission happens, coronavirus, each person spreads to a couple of other people. And actually a study of the most popular content on Facebook between, I think it was about over the last 2-3 years, found that it was a very similar magnitude of transmission at the individual level. So for the most popular stuff, think of like Ice Bucket Challenge, this kind of content. Each person on average was spreading it to a couple of others. But the difference with the timescale, that obviously for coronavirus, that infection process takes a few days, whereas online we're talking maybe 30 seconds after someone sees something and sharing it. So in some cases, the actual individual level extent of transmission is very similar, but it's the timescale that means that online content seems like a much faster outbreak, because it's really just the speed at which each round of infection occurs.
Okay, so just in that answer, you started to talk a little bit about, I think, what we're calling colloquially at the moment, this idea of people who are asymptomatic. They don't have any symptoms, but they are still infectious. Do you think it's possible to have people who are asymptomatic when it comes to thoughts, ideas, content and things like that, but still to actually be able to increase that transmission probability?
I think it would depend a bit on the thing we're talking about. I mean, I guess one of the most common areas for research in this is online content. So to some extent, it's measurable because we can see what people are posting. But of course, in reality, it's not so clear. And I think that that is a really good question, because typically when we talk about symptoms in disease, for something like coronavirus, a sort of defined clinical case doesn't necessarily just refer to only people with symptoms. It refers to people who have symptoms that would make them identifiable as someone who's got that. So we could have, for instance, people with an idea or belief who they might not be clearly identifiable as having that idea or being a proponent of that idea, but their actions enable that idea to spread in some way. So I think you could, to some extent, have this analogy that if you had to go out, for example, among your friends and say, which of your friends is a clear advocate for this particular opinion on something, you might identify a few people, but actually have other people in your group who help those things spread through much subtler behaviours that would be harder to pick out at first glance. These concepts really apply across ideas. I think a lot of the attention, certainly has been around in the last couple of years, misinformation and harmful content and people who've taken advantage of these things. But I think this idea that things can that can trigger a strong emotional response, that can be a positive response as well as these more manipulative emotions like fear and anger. You can have things that will trigger awe, for example. And we've seen recently a lot of things that have received a lot of attention have been very positive messages, things around NHS and this sort of thing. So I think there is that element to it, certainly. I think also information that is practical and useful, again, going back to through our evolutionary history of survival instincts, that we value things that we think are kind of helpful. So I think there are those other elements to content which can improve transmission, but can be used to ensure that the things that are spreading are positive as well as the things that we hear about more commonly.
I am really conscious of your time. So one last question for you today, and that is, what one insight about your field would you like for business leaders around the world to take into their fields?
I think the overarching thing about outbreaks is really thinking about those different elements of the transmission process. It's not just about the thing that's being transmitted. It's about the interactions through which it spreads. It's about the susceptibility. It's about competition with other things that are spreading. And I think there's often a tendency, whether we're talking about infectious diseases or whether we're talking about marketing or approaches to violence, to converge on quite simple explanations for what we're seeing. But I think it is really important to actually test those against what we see. You know, if we think we have an explanation for why something's taken off, to really test that and see if that holds in general. And then likewise, think more about what happens next. I think there's often a focus very much on something's gone viral or it hasn't. Whereas in reality, some things spread moderately, some things spread quickly, some last a long time, some die away. So I think really focusing on those aspects of transmission and focusing on the full dynamics of the outbreak rather than just those very early stages can give you a lot more insight into how things are going to take off.
I think that's an incredible way of approaching a lot of the work that we do. Thank you so much for your time today, Adam. Best of luck with the launch of your book. I know that it's available at the moment. And best of luck with all the work that I know you're doing with regards to COVID-19. I'm sure it's an incredibly busy time for you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for listening, and please join us for the next episode of AKQA Insight.